Let's Face the Issues with Dr. Jean A. Youngblood is brought to you by First Conservative Baptist Church. Now let's get back to Let's Face the Issues with Dr. Jean A. Youngblood.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're having a discussion today on the air with Daryl Kane. He's the presidential candidate for 2024. We're talking about the current election and the declension that we're finding in the voter turnout, as historically has been the case, but decreasing in that number down through the years. In fact, Daryl, before the news break, we were talking about some of the statistical data. And according to the statistical data that I found, some 25 million Christians today are still not registered to vote. 31 million Christians did not vote in the presidential election in 2016. And so that goes back to the very point that you were discussing before our news break of the need for involvement. But one of the things that we were also talking about was that of ballot harvesting. Now, explain to our listeners, some are not aware of what that term means. I've talked about it a number of times on the broadcast, but for the clarification for our listeners, what is ballot harvesting? What is wrong with it? How many states are changing the laws at the last minute to do the ballot harvesting? And how should we respond to that as conservatives?
Yeah, this is a critically important topic. And so my understanding of ballot harvesting, and again, I add a second tier to what I consider to be ballot harvesting. So there's two levels. So first level is, you know, third parties getting involved and getting involved in people's mail-in votes and helping to steer them and quite literally, you know, harvest them in a direction, sometimes even just taking, replacing, and all sorts of fraud potential. And I think that's generally when we as conservatives are talking about ballot harvesting, that's what we're talking about. And that's obviously, as I said, a very comfortable conversation to make. But there's even a second layer of what I consider to be ballot harvesting, which is perhaps to me even more alarming. And this is why when the pandemic started, my biggest concern became how we were going to prevent a quote-unquote modernization of the way in which we vote. Because when we're reorganizing everything in our society around being home-based and doing things mobily, remotely, avoiding interaction as much as possible, it is very difficult to make a counter-argument to why, for some reason, this thing going to vote requires physically going and going out and doing all these things. And now you have so many of the states have expanded the mail-in voting process. And the problem with that, why that's so difficult and concerning for us, is that that's going to introduce tens of millions of Americans that probably would not have been willing to get up, wipe the crumbs off of their shirt, get in the car, and drive 90 minutes to vote. They probably weren't willing to do that, but as it becomes easier and easier to vote, the more likely they are to do it. So, you know, we need to recognize this conversation. As a Republican Party, we have to recognize this conversation. We have to not be afraid of it, because if we don't get involved in this conversation in a forceful, again, forceful and proactive way, this is going to be the end of our viability as a national party. And on the one hand, I mean, if the left could have their way, it'd be a button on your phone that you could push, because they already do outnumber us. In states like Pennsylvania, there are many more degenerate thugs in downtown Philadelphia than there are farmers across that state, right? The difference is that the farmers are going out and voting. And, you know, the degenerate thugs are not always going out and voting. But now what you have, and this is, I can give you a very specific example of this as to what is so alarming about the mail-in voting process that we have and why this adds an additional layer that, you know, we have to compensate for if we're going to win, that goes even beyond the challenges of 2016. So during everything that's occurred in the state, at a certain point in time, I had to stay at an extended stay hotel for a week. I had a corporate rental there. And when I went in to check in, I was greeted by the person working there had a big extended stay shirt on. This was their corporate shirt that they're all wearing. and it says on it in very big letters, it says vote. And in front of you, there is a giant poster. It's the first thing that you see, it's suspended right in front of you, explaining to you how your extended stay is your voting location. And there's a flyer, and there's this is how we can do it. This is how you, and the verbiage, and it becomes very easy once the state gets involved, it becomes very easy for them to sort of slyly help steer. And this is, again, another layer of voter harvesting, which is, oh, we can give you the facts on the issues. And this is this. And ever since, you know, this has started in California, I get text messages on my phone every day. Hey, are you registered yet? Are you, do you know the facts of the election? So translate that out. That means that you have an extended stay motel that is populated by who knows who, and now suddenly they're being advertised on how to vote, how to simply vote with the push of a button. And this is a corporate entity that is involved in this. Corporate America. Everybody is all hands on deck to expand that voter base. Very concerning. And they're able to do these things in a way where, oh, we're just educating people about voting. We want as many voices heard as possible. Well, I don't necessarily want as many voices heard as possible. Okay? We have many people, millions of people in this country that, frankly, have no business having any say in the future of our nation. So this is an uncomfortable conversation, but we're going to have it. And frankly, in my opinion, the left has done us a service because they've introduced the conversation. They've opened the conversation. So in California, they're already talking about lowering the voter age to 16. So these types of things. And when they do these things, we need to counter with our voter electoral reform. So, okay, so you want to tell the American people why the voting age should be 16. Well, we want to tell you why voting status should be restricted to contributing Americans that are net contributors and not net takers, right? So we need to start changing the policy. We need to start really defining for the American people what a citizen actually is, what that entails, because there is a very big difference between a resident and a citizen. And as far as I'm concerned, I don't want residents voting. I want citizens voting. I want people that take their civic duty seriously and are putting forth a good faith effort to do their part. And those are the people that I want to hear from. I don't want to hear from the crackheads that were just released from prison that are living off of your tax dollars. I don't want to hear from them, frankly, on election day. So, and I'm not afraid to say that. But what this means in this election, to dovetail this, to wrap this up, we have a lot of new votes that are coming in. And that is an additional challenge. When you look electorally in what occurred in 2016, Donald Trump did not win the popular vote. He won because in the Rust Belt, states that Hillary Clinton neglected because she thought they were in the bag, he won by a narrow margin in an unexpected manner. 4 years later, the trajectory of those states, the demographics, the number of good, God-fearing people, that number has not increased. So as that number continues to decrease, as their majority continues to grow, our engagement has to grow to counter that. And then once we're in office, we have to do things to change those trend lines. That's the only way that we get this country back on track. So we need to vote and we need to pray. That's
absolutely,
that's what we have to do. And the last thing, I know I'm talking quite a bit, but such a critical point that you make about Christians not being registered. And, you know, you posted a stat about a certain percentage of Christians do not believe in the sovereignty of Jesus Christ. And that's not a Christian if you don't believe. That is what it is to be a Christian. And absolutely. I got into one of these conversations the other day where, you know, there's this subtle effort to denigrate Jesus Christ, to remove him from his seat at the right hand of God, and to place him as one of many gurus in a growing list of New Age philosophies. And to do that is to destroy it altogether. And there is no the Lord, liar, or lunatic. That is the reality. You have to pick one. Which one is he to you? His
That's
word
right.
leaves no ambiguity. If you
That's
believe
right.
in Jesus Christ, he is not one of many gurus worth listening to. He is your one and only path to salvation. And
well,
as
I've used the term Daryl quite a few times. He is either Lord of all or he's not Lord at all. But going back to some of the thoughts that you have just postulated for our listeners to understand, one of the things that is frightening, and yet I understand the need to, how would you say, engage as many people in voting as possible, and part of that is by mail, part of that is electronically, etc. I'm looking at an article here that gives a good illustration of a mail-in vote and the potential fiasco with that. The article says, Florida woman forced to forfeit her lotto prize after the United States Postal Services loses her ticket. Her tracking information last showed the ticket was in transit August the 12th at Tallahassee Post Office. The article then reads, Sue Burgess of Hernando County said that she was thrilled to discover earlier this summer that she had snagged a $1,000 in the state's second chance lottery game. I was elated, she said. It was like winning $1 million to me, she told the news. But at that time, she couldn't claim her winnings at the local lottery office since they were closed due to the pandemic. She followed the state's lottery instructions and went to the post office to send her ticket via certified mail to the outlet. The outlet reported, that is the news. Burgess said that the ticket, however, never made it to the lotto office in 1 week's time frame as required to claim the prize. Her tracking information last showed the ticket was in transit on August the 12th at the Tallahassee Post Office. Quote, they said, we have not received this ticket, end quote. No ticket, no prize, said Burgess, whose prize money went to an alternate winner. 6 weeks later, the winning ticket is still unaccounted for. That gives you a good illustration. If they can't keep up with a certified letter with a winning ticket from the lotto in it, if they can't get it from point A to point B in transition, how can we expect success in the mail-in vote in the United States of America? And one of the things, Daryl, that I want us to think on and to have you to address for the benefit of our listeners, we're already talking about several states that have filed suit and either won the case or it's still pending that will allow votes to be counted up to 2 weeks after November the 3rd, 2 weeks after the election date. And it's on the basis that if those mail-in ballots have up to and including November the 3rd postmark, then they can be counted regardless of the number of days after the election takes place. Now, that sets the stage for a major, major, major fraud right. in the ballots. Picture printing 1 million ballots, posting those on some postage machines across America, and then dumping those by the hundreds of thousands at the different voting precincts across America, where only as they see the vote count not giving Joe Biden the winning edge, and as a result of that, dumping more and more of those in it. Here's an article that says the U.S. Supreme Court halts expansion of the Arizona ballot harvesting. And when it talks about ballot harvesting, as our listeners perhaps already know, and as you've articulated so well, it's where people go out, second or third party, go out, and they go to the nursing homes. That's the reason some of them calling them granny ballots, where they go into the nursing homes and retirement centers and say, we'll do this for you. We want to get your ballot in. And they'll get them to sign it and photo with their cell phone, photo their Social Security card and their driver's license, and supposedly voting, taking their ballot in, but they will vote that ballot for them the way they want it voted. So that's very, very, very hazardous, I believe, for the election that we're faced with that's coming up now. What are your responses to that? How should we view it? I understand we need to keep praying. I understand we need to be alert. I understand and realize, and believe most of our listeners do, that we need to ask God to divinely intervene as he did in 2016, but also believe that there needs to be some brakes put on, and some of the courts across the nation In fact, on one of the occasions, in several of the states, that is, the courts have already said, we're not going to allow it, but we're not going to make the ruling right now. So everything has to remain in a whole status as to what the election process was before this election, so that after the election we can finalize any changes. How do you respond to that potentiality? Literally millions of ballots that are fraudulent ballots coming in days and days and days, up to 2 weeks after the election. How do we ever know for a certainty who won?
Yeah, mail-in voting is a disaster. And, certainly. And that's a very real example of why. And there's a myriad of reasons why. But this is a very bad and destructive thing. You know, forget voter harvesting at nursing homes. You now have voter harvesting at, motels. And you have the corporations working in conjunction to steer in that result. So this is very alarming. And, yeah, we need to be doing everything that we can. There is a battle for the battle about, preventing this. And this thing about waiting 2 weeks after, this is one thing I think is probably very unlikely that we could probably all agree on, is having an election night like we're used to, where we all sit and watch our televisions, and at 9:30, we get a result that we either like or we don't like, and we either go to bed happy or we go to bed sad. This is going to be something that's most likely going to be dragging on, and it's probably going to be very ugly. And it speaks to the breakdown of our system. This is a reality, and this is not something to I don't necessarily even think that the breakdown of our system is something to resist. I think that we have to recognize what is going on. We are in a nonviolent civil war. You know, there is a veneer of civility that has been slowly falling away. You know, in the first debate, by the way, a lot of people have talked about how this was just so uncivil and how disappointing it was. And yes, it is. But this is the reality. We are not two sides that are going to be reconciled. And I'd rather have two guys out there punching at each other and making it very clear how they feel about each other than having a phony and a disingenuous conversation where, we're pretending that there's any sort of connection at all between what we're about. And there isn't. And this debate, by the way, brought up to a couple, many very important things. And I do want to applaud, first off, President Trump. I thought that it was a fantastic, dominant performance. And when I say that, I'm not a person that always scores things that way. I try and sort of be objective, obviously. My feelings are the Democrats, every word that comes out of their mouth is abject treason. So they don't ever win a debate. So when I use the term win, I don't want the audience to misinterpret that. But, in 2016, as an example, I only felt that Donald Trump really won one of the three debates. I thought that the second debate, and that was turned out to be the most important one, because that was when there was a very big news scandal, and it was at the bottom point where it showed him down 10 points, and everybody was just saying this thing was over, and he had a very strong performance, and that was the town hall forum. But, the first debate, really just being ambushed by Lester Holt's totally offensive moderating. And the third debate, which was more of a tie, but I ultimately felt like, he didn't. I felt like this first debate was a big win for him. And I feel that if the debates are able to continue for his health, for whatever reasons, they will continue to be a big win. And the reason for that, Trump is very much so, he is a little bit of a aggressive guy, and he is a little bit out of bounds and outside of the rules. And a lot of people have said that was not a good thing, how he came off that way. But I think that Joe Biden is really the perfect candidate for him to be himself. And, as someone that does debates with people, I don't look to debate with women. And, there's a number of reasons for that. I mean, first and foremost, I do feel that politics are an inherently masculine thing. And I think that,
yes,
it's inherently incumbent upon men to enter the arena. But psychologically, when I'm going into a debate against someone, I'm thinking about it like it's a boxing match. I'm thinking about taking punches and throwing punches. And psychologically, I don't enjoy juxtaposing that with going up against a woman. And, from an audience perspective, it can come off very differently if a Donald Trump is jumping over a moderator and landing punches. But Joe Biden carries himself as though he's a tough Irish Catholic red-blooded American. And because he does that, it's his persona. But it is a fake persona. And because that's his persona, because he also likes to make off-the-cuff remarks, it sort of gives Trump a pass. And so what you have is you have two men that are presenting themselves as alphas, and one of them very clearly is, and one of them very clearly isn't. You know, Joe Biden, there's a very awkward disconnect between how he presents himself, again, as a sort of red-blooded Catholic, hey, let's go out back and talk about this guy, and his politics and everything that he stands for, which are totally effeminate and weak. There is nothing tough about Joe Biden, okay? An alpha is a protector and a provider. Joe Biden is a sellout and a traitor. A person that really, the only thing that Joe Biden really cares about is fame and recognition. So that's he has offered himself up to a party that hates everything that he is. He is a white man, and that is everything that they hate. And he is well aware of that. So everything that he does is about apologizing for who he is. And he has simply offered himself up and said, I will be your Trojan horse. And
that's
you can
exactly
all come inside of me, and, you know, I will help set whites at ease. And then once I'm in, I don't care. You guys can run out and do whatever you want. I just want to be known as the battering ram that opened the gates one final time. So he's a very
That's a good transition for us to take. We've got a few minutes left on the broadcast. Let's make a transition with that thought. Share with our listeners your sense of, what will the Joe Biden America look like if that's the way the election goes? What can we expect morally, ethically, theologically, doctrinally, constitutionally, Bill of Rights, et cetera? What kind of America will a Joe Biden America be like?
Yeah, that's exactly where it was transitioning to. Very concerning. The main thing, really, because you have to understand, with the Democrats, any sort of differences in performance, racial, gender, etc., that does not favor their groups has to be remedied. So, you know, in places like academia, this becomes a very costly exercise to the American people, in that it costs a lot of money for them to constantly promote and funnel their core groups upward and to constantly funnel you downward. I have been saying for years that when it comes to law enforcement, this becomes physically dangerous to the American people. Because the reality is that we have a community that is committing violent crimes at a rate of 7 times the rest of their citizens. And obviously the rational response to that would be, okay, what's going on with these communities? How can we stop them from committing these crimes? What changes do we need to do? What conversation do we need to have? But instead, what we have is a total dissecting of our laws and law enforcement to rearrange our society around lowering their interactions with law enforcement. So what that means is that violent crime laws, assault laws, are inherently biased and that they need to be adjusted. And one of the parts of the conversation that I thought was so interesting was on the topic of law enforcement. And when Joe Biden was pressed on it and came off very poorly, the best that he could muster for how he wants to, quote unquote, help law enforcement is to equip them with psychiatrists and social workers to sit in the passenger seats with them on 911 calls, play the tape. That's what he says.
If that weren't so sad, it would be comical.
But this is deeply disturbing on 911 calls. So when you're calling because an armed burglar is breaking into your house, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris want a social worker in the passenger seat explaining to your law enforcement officer why he's inherently racist and how he needs to compensate for that on the crime scene. Okay, this is very dangerous. In California, police officers' stations are already being closed because on a state level, we are defunding the police. And the attitude behind it, and then again, the conversation of implicit bias training, and that is a wonderful thing that Donald Trump is removing this nonsense. They are taking every police officer in the country and sitting them down and first explaining to them how they're racist and then explaining to them how they have to make adjustments for that. The only thing that law enforcement needs to be trained on is the law and law enforcement. And anything other than that places you in extreme danger. So what you're going to have is the last line of defense, which is quite literally law enforcement, that's gone. It's going to be open season on Christians, on whites, on traditional Americans. And what you're going to have is you're going to have criminals behaving in unprecedented brazenness in this country, breaking in, looting, taking what they want, and God willing, you even get a police officer out there. Instead of waiting 10 minutes, you're going to wait an hour. And by the time you get there, who knows who's going to show up? Because you may be calling the police because someone's breaking into your store and stealing your money, but you get some biracial lesbian who shows up, and she spends the first hour interviewing you about what you're bringing to the crime scene. And this is no good. And obviously, from a moral perspective, we will have a continuation on the defiling of everything that is good and virtuous. So this will be the final offense against God, because in a democracy, we are ultimately responsible for who's in the office. So we are inviting God's judgment. And by not electing a right person, you know, that's really the last thing, is that, you know, he could perhaps protect us from these things. So maybe what we have, thankfully, is that we will have a Supreme Court firewall, and that will be your only line of defense as the American people against what is coming. And perhaps they'll stack the bench. So
Darryl, we've got about a minute and 45 seconds left on the broadcast. Two things that I want you to finalize in our discussion today. The nomination of Amy Coney Barrett, and was that a good thing for the president to do? Do you think that that can be completed before the election? And the second thing is, tell our listeners about your candidacy for president for 2024, what your hopes, aims, and goals are, and we've got about a minute and a half left to do that.
Fantastic, obviously, that we will have a 5.5 to 3.5 Supreme Court split. That will be fantastic. So having her on is very good. I did not like, frankly, that Donald Trump went out ahead of time and said that he would be putting a woman on the bench. You know, being a justice, again, that's an inherently masculine thing. So to actually preclude men from that as a gift to the left, that's, you know, frankly, that's not something that I would have done. And I can't support that. But I'm happy that she's on there, and I'm confident that she will vote the right way. My campaign in 2024 is going to be about reclaiming the country and continuing a process that has started with Donald Trump, which is a more masculine, paternal, and proactive Republican Party that is less concerned with size of government and more concerned with solutions and doing what needs to be done to set our country back in place. And some of those things may be uncomfortable. They may be outside of the bounds of what we as conservatives have been comfortable arguing for. But if we do not adopt that, and if we do not become a far more aggressive conservative right-wing movement, it's a matter of time. Whether we are able to survive this election or not, eventually it's game over for us. So when we have the ball, we have to be putting points on the board, and that's always what I'll be looking to do as candidate in 2024. But again, all of that goes on the sidelines for the next month. This month is about Donald Trump needs to be elected. Pray, vote. Yes. God bless you. Thank you so much.
Yes. Thank you so much, ladies and gentlemen, for joining us today. Looking forward to meeting you next time on the air as, once again, we face the issues.
7 p.m. Wednesday, Fellowship Meal Bible Study. Prayer, Bible Q&A, and updates on issues facing our city, state, and country. Tune in again for another Let's Face the Issues broadcast. Also tune in this same station Saturday mornings at 9 for expository Bible preaching by Dr. Youngblood. Remember, a rebroadcast of this program can be heard every evening, 9 p.m. on 100.3 FM. Tune in and invite others to listen.